G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. Don't forget to sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, Ira.
Boker Raton, Jono. That's how we say Boker Tov here in Florida.
That's right. The mouth for that, is that right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. It's our little joke here.
It's our little joke in Florida. Good day to everybody listening in Florida. Today we are in Job chapter 8. It's Bildad's turn, isn't it?
Yeah, another one of these wonderful friends of Job.
A good mate, Bildad, no doubt. We're going to get stuck into this and see how good a friend he is. It begins like this. Ira, are we set?
Yeah, we're ready. Let's go.
Bildad the Shuhite?
Yep. Shuhi. Hashuhi.
Hashuhi. Okay. Yep. That's where he's from. He answered Job, and he said, "Oh, how long will you speak these things? My goodness, you're like, your words there of your mouth are like a strong wind." Right there and then, you just wish that the earth would open up and either swallow him or swallow you. What he's doing, Ira, is he's taking Job's words from 6:26. And if I go back there, Job, poor Job, he says, "Do you intend to rebuke my words and the speeches of a despised one, which are as wind?" And here he says, Bildad takes those and he says, "Oh, dude, you're full of hot air. You just go on and on and on. And when are you going to stop? Because we all know what's going on."
Yeah, we're actually going to see similar things like this all throughout the chapter where, you know, things that Job have said are going to be thrown back into his face. And typically what we would say is, you know, basically he's calling Job a windbag. But actually, when we read the Hebrew, the Ruach Kavir, you know, basically what this is talking about is a destructive wind, you know, a very strong wind and a destructive wind. So, you know, it could kind of have a twofold meaning here, but he's basically talking about his words being very destructive at the same time.
Okay, so he's adding to it. He goes on to say, "Does God subvert judgments, or does the Almighty pervert justice?" And here in verse 4, 5, and 6, we have three ifs that I've circled. Shall I read all three of them, and then I'll let you touch on it?
Sure.
Let me go. "If your sons have sinned against him," being God, "he will cast them away for their transgression." And now then you love the ifs. I love the way he puts the ifs there. It's like, you know, your sons are gone, therefore what I'm saying is true. But he says, "If your sons have sinned against him, he will cast them away for their transgression. If you would earnestly seek God," if, clearly, Job, what I'm telling you is that you're not, "but if you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if," in verse 6, "if you were pure and upright," now, oh man, this guy bugs me already. "If you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper you, your rightful dwelling place." I'll read 7 as well. "Though your beginnings were small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly." It's interesting in 6, and I know we're going to go back to 4, but it's interesting in 6, "if you were pure and upright," and he's actually taking the words of God, unbeknownst to him, but God describes him as such in the opening chapters, that God is a pure and Job is a pure and upright servant.
Right. We're actually going to see later in the chapter actually the exact words that are used, because it's not the zach, which is pure, and that zach there is like when we read about the description, say, of the olive oil that's used in the Mishkan, it's called zayid zach. You know, this pure oil. So there's, you know, this idea of being filtered and pure and so forth. You know, it's not even like, you know, Bildad is allowing for just any type of, you know, if you are really pure. So he's basically giving him the thing again, that there has to be something wrong with you. There has to be some blemish, some type of sin in your life.
But not even just something wrong with you, but clearly there was something wrong with your sons as well, and that's why they were wiped off the face of the earth in verse 4.
Right. So I just want to go back for 3 for a minute, because this idea of, the idea of whether or not God would pervert, God would pervert justice and the Almighty pervert righteousness. He's basically saying, can God do anything that is not just? And when we look at the first 2 verses and remembering what Job's responses were in the last 2 chapters, we have to understand that kind of accepting Job's response, we have to accept one or two possibilities. Mm-hmm. And we touched on these briefly at the end of last week's show. One, that Yehovah does not have the ability to judge properly, and this is Job's perspective again. Mm-hmm. Or two, that despite the fact that he has the ability to judge, he's actually made a conscious decision not to do so. And from Job's perspective, it's like because the lowly nature of human beings causes Yehovah to somehow disassociate himself. But, you know, if we're going to accept the first scenario, then, you know, what ends up happening is it casts aspersions on us as the creator, which is kind of, you know, kind of a little bit shocking. And I'm bringing this because I think what we have to notice is, and we're going to see towards the end of this chapter, that, you know, while Bildad and Eliphaz and the friends are really not right, you know, in a sense, Job isn't either. And we're starting to see the beginning of the preparation that Yehovah is having to get Job to change his kind of perspective.
Can I just let me see if I've got that straight in my head?
Sure.
Because
sure.
I remember we talked about the arrows, for example, and that are mentioned in the previous chapters. Job complains and says, "Look, I've been shot with the arrows of the Almighty. He has targeted me. He's shot me with his arrows. His poison arrows, no less." And I made the connection that we often see the analogy of arrows either in the judgments of God or in the wrath of God, which can often be the same things, of course. And so, but this is the way that his friends say it. Either God is angry with you for some reason or he's judging you, and
right.
This is a just punishment for something that you've done. But we know that that isn't the case. And yet the other options, as Job sees it, if I understand what you're suggesting, is that Job is trying to reason what's going on, and perhaps what's going on in his mind is either, because he knows that he hasn't done anything wrong, either God is not able to judge correctly, he doesn't have the power to uphold justice as he should, or he's incorrectly judging me for something I haven't done. Are they the two options that we're looking at?
Right, or he's just disassociates himself because he's so, remember we talked about him kind of standing on his high and lofty tower, uh-huh. You know, looking down and not being able to see man. Remember that Job kind of made this argument that what is man that you are, you know, why is man such the subject of such constant testing? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the same thing that the psalmist says. But, you know, Job puts a much more, you know, negative slant on it than when the psalmist says, you know, what is man that you are mindful of him? You know, Job mm-hmm. is saying, why am I so important? Remember that you have to spend so much time testing me in this way. Remember
That's,
where we talked about him.
Yeah,
kind of being.
You should visit him every morning and test him every moment. How long?
Right. We talked about him kind of being in this balance of, like, you know, just on the edge of death, but God not allowing him to die. You know, it's a terrible place to be. Mm. You know, moving forward, like you said, there's something that I really want to deal with tonight. Because it's this idea of what you read about starting in verse 4, these ifs, you know, im banecha chatulo vayishlachem biyad pisham, where it says, and if your children sinned against him, then he sent them into the power of their transgressions, is one interpretation. You know, I look at it like if your son sinned against them, it actually says he sent them in the hand of their transgression, biyad pisham. So what he's saying there, Bildad, is something bad happened to your children, Job. It's because they sinned and got what was coming to them, basically.
Right, so they brought it upon themselves, right?
And right. And remember, in Job chapter 1, verse 5, we read about this. You know, we read about this idea, and we talked about it, that it was when it actually says it was in the Hebrew, in the English, it would say it was when the surrounding days of the feasts, and Eos sent to consecrate them rising early in the morning, and he went up with burnt offerings, a number for all of them. Eov would say, perhaps my sons have sinned and cursed Elohim in their hearts. Thus Eov would do all the days, from Job chapter 1, verse 5. And remember, we made the distinction between that word mishteh, you know, which is the Hebrew for feast there, as opposed to what we typically see as moedim, you know, or festivals.
Incidentally, Ira, there must have been, mm-hmm. I mean, clearly there was cause for concern in Job. I mean, he obviously didn't have enough faith in his sons to think you know, they're good boys. You know, right. Yeah, they're having a good time or whatever, but they're good boys and they're responsible and I don't have to worry about them. But in actual fact, what goes through his mind is, who knows what they've done? I mean, maybe they've even cursed God. I mean, who knows? I will offer sacrifices as the head of my household and do what I can to sustain them, I suppose.
Right, and so in a sense, we see that Bildad is showing a disturbing lack of compassion for his grieving friend. You know, I mean, we already know what he looks like. We already know what he's going through. But at the same time, it seems like, in a sense, that Bildad also exposes an inconsistency here in what Eov is, you know, is in what he's saying. Because in a sense, from Job chapter 1, verse 5, we can argue that Eov admitted that his children must have deserved punishment. We know that they were enjoying their festivities and suddenly the house falls on them and kills them. And so there's this sense of maybe their overindulgence, you know, must
and
have caused
them. Certainly, at the very least, there's an acknowledgement of the possibility that right. they had brought it upon themselves. Yeah.
So in this case, related to his own children, it seems that Eov was willing to recognize the justice of God, but when it comes to himself, he is unwilling to accept God's judgment. And that's the inconsistency that I think Bildad is uncovering here. And this is kind of an important lesson for all of us here, because how often do we apply our theology to others and then excuse ourselves for the same things? You know, and there's another thing that we see that's really interesting, a careful wording of this verse. We see something else that's important, because we assume that Bildad is saying that God sent Eov's sons away as punishment for their sins. Instead, it says he sent them away in a place, Biyad Pisham, of their sins. And this concept is really not necessarily an easy one to grasp. Because we most likely think of punishment as kind of a divine retaliation for the offense committed. Mm. And Bildad instead is describing it differently. He's kind of saying it that the transgression is in and of itself a place. It's almost like this idea of the free will choice moves us in the direction that we want to go, and then the result of those choices bring us to our desired destination. And so it's kind of like we are what we chose, and we are where we want to be. And so this is where I wanted to bring this discussion kind of to another place that we've touched on a couple of times as it relates to this idea of free will and choice, because I've been getting a lot of feedback. I don't know about you on this show, and I've been getting a lot of feedback when we talked about Hasatan and when we brought up the concept of evil. And one of the things that you recommended to the listeners was that people should start doing a study on the idea of evil and kind of maybe change their perspective, kind of have a Tanakh perspective of evil rather than the typical perspective out there related to Hasatan or capital S Satan and this idea of evil. So I thought we needed to take a little time tonight before we go through the rest of Job chapter 8 to deal with the subject of evil. We have a friend of this show, of my show, a friend of Torah Pearls. Probably there's been shout outs to her before, Ida in Florida. And she emailed me this week, and she was quite, not disturbed, but she was asking questions about this concept of evil, and she was having a hard time wrapping her head around the whole concept. Sure. Because naturally what happens is people key on a particular thing. So for her, she said, look, I understand, and I look at the verses that you guys are bringing, and I see what it says, and I believe absolutely that when Yehovah says something, that that's what it means. She says, but then I look at the idea of something like pedophilia, you know, and she goes, I can't wrap my mind around God creating that. And I said, that's where the issue is that people don't understand what evil is. And so I want to go into a couple of verses here, if you'll allow me.
Please.
And the first one that I want to deal with is in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9. And in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9, we're seeing that the first time that we see the word in Hebrew for evil related to a tree in Gan Eden. Mm-hmm. And it says, and Yehovah Elohim caused to grow from the ground every tree that is pleasing to the sight and good for food, the tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and of evil. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, the whole discussion that we had sparked this controversy. And one of the verses that we specifically brought was Yotzer or uvorechoshech osa shalom vibora ra ani yehova osa kol eleh, which says, I form light and create darkness, I make peace and create evil, I, Yehovah, do or make all these things. And so when we look at this word translated as evil in the Tanakh, is this word ra, which is resh ayin ayin, is the root of this. We see another time that we see this is in Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, as it relates to Noah. And it says, Vayar Yehovah ki rabah ra'ah ha'adam ba'aretz v'kol yetzer machshevot libo rak ra kol hayom. And Yehovah saw that great was ra'at, the evil of man in the earth. And there's a really interesting word there, and that's the word yetzer. A lot of people will remember that word and think about the word because they hear the term yetzer hara all the time, meaning the evil inclination. But yetzer actually, in a lot of the translations, will say intent. So it would say something like, and Yehovah saw that great was evil of man in the earth, and the intent of the thoughts of his heart were nothing but evil. Ra, kol hayom, all the time. But actually, that word yetzer actually means nature. It's our nature, talking about the nature of man, the nature of the thoughts of his heart. And this is where we have an incredible insight into the concept of evil from a Hebrew or a Tanakh perspective. That word yetzer is the noun form of the Hebrew verb yatzar, which means to form something. Or to fashion something, kind of like in the same way that we see bara, which is create, and we saw that thing bore. I create light. And what was the evil in men that we saw that Yehovah was talking about as it relates to the days of Noah? It says in Genesis chapter 6, verses 11 through 13. I'll just read the English, and I'll read the English how it reads from the Hebrew. In verse 11, the earth became corrupt before Elohim. The earth was filled with chamas, with violence. Chamas, like that's the same word as Hamas, who are the enemies of Israel today. Mm-hmm. And when Elohim saw how corrupt the earth was, that word corrupt there is from the Nephal form. It actually almost means that how the earth corrupted itself. Because all flesh had corrupted its ways on the earth. Elohim said to Noah, I have decided to put an end to all flesh, or an end to all flesh comes before me, literally, for the earth is filled with chamas, with violence because of them, or from before their face. Behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. So when we look at these verses and we see the use of ra, and this idea of yetzer, and we use evil as an adjective, it kind of describes the state of man. It describes this nature that we're talking about, or this form, this idea of forming something as it relates to the verb. Like moving forward, so really what it is that they filled the earth with violence, and thus their ways became corrupt, and the world became corrupt, right? You following me? Okay. Sure. So then in Genesis 8:21 we read another verse that says, and Yehovah smelled the pleasing odor, and Yehovah said to himself, never again will I doom the earth because of man, since the devisings of man's mind are evil, ra, from his youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living being as I have done. So just as in Bereshit 6:5, the recognition here is that men plan, form evil. And then lastly, even though he creates it, it's talking about this nature or state of man's mind. And then lastly, let's look at the evil in the sense of a spirit. And I think I don't remember if you brought some of these verses, but you did bring verses like this. Mm-hmm. This is actually from Shmuel Aleph, from 1 Samuel 16:14, 15, 16, and 23. And these are all related to Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, and David. And it actually says in verse 14, now the spirit of Yehovah had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit, a ruach ra'ah, from Yehovah began to terrify him. And then in 15 it says, Saul's courtiers said to him, an evil spirit of Elohim, ruach Elohim ra'ah, is terrifying you. Let our Lord.
I have to giggle, Ira, because
why?
Because in the because of the question that that you are addressing and doing such a great job, and I appreciate that. In my English translation, in the New King James, we can't have that. We can't have an evil spirit. An evil spirit doesn't come from the Lord. We have to call that a distressing spirit.
Ooh, a distressing spirit.
But it's the same word, right? It's the same word that we're...
Of course it is. Of course it is, yeah.
And so here we have, I'll read it to you from mine. The spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Lord troubled him. I would encourage everyone to just grab your, if you've got your Christian translation, your English Bible, and just see what it says. Verse 15, and Saul's servants said to him, surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you. Let our master now command your servant, who are before you, to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp, and it shall be that he will play it with his hands when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, and you shall be well. And so off they went to find David.
Right, so all of those three verses, that verse and then another verse, the other one that I was going to bring, says the same thing. And then what would the Spirit cause him to do? If you look at, again, Shmuel Aleph 1 Samuel 18, 10 through 12, we read, the next day an evil spirit of Elohim, Ruach Elohim Ra'ah, again, gripped Saul, and he began to rave in the house where David was playing the lyre as he did daily. Shaul had a spear in his hand, and Shaul threw the spear, thinking to pin David to the wall. But David eluded him twice, and Saul was afraid of David, for Yehovah was with him, and in turn had turned away from Saul. And then also in chapter 19, verse 9 and 10, then an evil spirit of Yehovah, Ruach Yehovah Ra'ah, again, came upon Saul while he was sitting in the house, and we see the same kind of thing, where he wanted to throw the spear.
And at least New King James is consistent in the book, because every single reference that he mentioned has it as distressing spirit, but distressing is the same word.
Right. So what we see is the evil in the spirit was something that vexed Saul and made him desire to hurt David. Mm-hmm. So then we get into this idea of this yetzer hara that we read about all the time. And really that's a rabbinic term, yetzer, where we see yetzer hara, an inclination of evil, and yetzer hatov, an inclination of good. You know, from a rabbinic perspective, and actually it's believed that this first was coined by Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer, who was known as the Baal Shem Tov, or the Besht for short. He was a Kabbalistic, you know, they believe he was the founder of Hasidic Judaism and a Kabbalistic rabbi. And he was the one. Baal Shem Tov means master of the, you know, the good name. And we've already seen in the Tanakh that Yetzer is from the verb yatzah, which means to form. So yetzah is the noun with that meaning, so it would be like the formation of something or a formed thing. And then yatzah is the verb form. It means to form in the sense of creating. Mm-hmm. You know, we already know about the verb bara, you know, which we talked about. So we see it in Isaiah 45 and 7 that we read, and seven other times in the Tanakh as well. We see that. We see this in Deuteronomy 31:21. It says, it shall be when we have found him, evils, ra'ot, multiplied in diseases, and shall testify the song, this before him to witness, for not shall it be forgotten from the mouths of their seed, for I know, it's et yetzru, which they make, or this formation or creation, which they make today before I bring them into the land which I've sworn. That's actually related to just before Hazinu, just before the poem or the song that's going to be brought forth. So Yehovah knew them from their creation as a nation that day and brought them into the land. And then we see in Yeshayahu in Isaiah 26:3, it says, we see it in Isaiah 26:3. I don't want to read all of them. So if people want the references, then in 29:16 it says, "Surely your turning of things upside down shall be esteemed as the potter's clay. For shall the work say of him that made it, Hayotzer? Hayotzer is talking about a potter. That basically he's going to say to the potter, you didn't make me, or you made me not. Or shall the thing formed, Vayetzer, say of him that formed it, Li Yotzru, he had no understanding. So we see, I'm bringing this for a reason. So here we see the former or creator, the Yotzer, spoken to by the one formed, showing that this indeed is the idea of formation of creation. Habakkuk, chapter 2, verse 18. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof has graven it, the molten image, and a teacher of lies, that the maker, Yotzer, of his work, Yitzru, of the created thing or the formed thing, trusts in to make dumb idols, okay? Mm. And so it shows that Yetzer, again, is also that which is formed not only of an idea or a thought, but of a physical object as well. In Chronicles, in Divrei Hayamim, Aleph, chapter 28, verse 9, and you, Shlomo, my son, and you, Solomon, my son, know Elohe, your father, and serve him with a complete soul, and delighting with all your heart, Yehovah seeks or searches all the nature, Yetzer, of your thoughts to understand. If you seek him, you will find him, and if you reject him, he will forsake you forever. So from these, we see that if we look at imagination as the formation of plans in the mind, then Yetzer does seem to apply here. It doesn't mean that when man plans to do harm or evil that this is sin. But it tells us that man is forming plans to do evil. And it is only once the evil plan is acted upon then the sin occurs. Evil in and of itself is not sin. It's not. We see this in Bereishit, chapter 4, verse 5 and 7, with Cain and Abel. For Cain and his gift he had no regard. Cain became exceedingly upset, and his face fell. Yehovah said to Cain, why are you so upset? Why is your face fallen? Is it not thus? If you intend good, bear it aloft or bring it up. But if you not intend good, at the entrance, la petach, at the entrance or at the doorway is sin, crouching toward you his desire, but you can rule over him. So here we have a situation where sin is not inside yet. It can be let in if the door is opened, yet it stands ready outside. And so we kind of see a metaphor that shows us that by not letting ourselves be discouraged and Yetzer forming harmful or bad plans, then we conquer sin. And so evil in this context is nothing more than the creation of free will. Evil, and this is what I told Ida when she wrote to me. I said, look, evil can only be created by Yehovah because there is nothing that is created that is not created by him.
Amen.
If he didn't create evil, then evil cannot exist and we cannot have free will. And just as we read a few weeks ago in Deuteronomy 8, what happened? Yehovah tested and tried Bnei Yisrael. Why? To see what was in their hearts. And that is what we can say in a way is happening here as well in our study of Eov. Mm-hmm. That what Yehovah is doing is testing and allowing this testing to see really what is in his heart.
Wow. So. I'm really glad that you were so comprehensive in regards to answering that question. I really do appreciate that, Ira.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, we touched on these things, and sometimes it should hit it. What happens is I'll look at a verse like that in 4 about the sons, and I know what people's typical responses, and a lot of people would probably be like Bildad in this. A lot of people that we know would probably be like that. But sometimes what happens is you'll ask me in the midst of a show, and I just at the moment I'm thinking of something else, and I can't wrap my head around it. And then I'll start preparing, you know, like I did for this, and I see that, and I go, "Wow, this is a perfect time to bring this," and I didn't want to miss the opportunity.
I appreciate that, and I like to think that that happens with the. I know that happens with me, and I like to think that that happens with the listeners. That after they listen to a program, you know, there's something else. There was a question that was asked, and they think about it, and they go to the Word, and they open it up, and they investigate things, and that's one of the things that I love about Truth to You Radio is that I really do like to think that not only between us, but all the listeners, that it heightens curiosity and it forces people to ask the questions, and that they're then motivated to go to the Word and do exactly what you've done, and find all of those verses and tie it together with explanation. I really do appreciate that, my friend. That really excites me.
Awesome. So then let's go on. So you read through verse 7. So in verse 5, we see, if you seek diligently for God and from Shaddai, you seek favor. I actually like to, sometimes I'm, I like the literal, even though sometimes it doesn't make sense, but that word, titchanan, at the end of Job chapter 8, verse 5, is also from the root chen, you know, where we get the idea of favor or grace, mm-hmm. and it's in the hitpael, which actually makes it's causative, so it's basically saying, if you cause yourself to be in a position of favor, in other words, if you seek diligently for God and from the Almighty, you cause yourself to be in a position of favor, mm-hmm. okay, if you are pure, and Yashah, upright, surely now he will rouse himself for you, and he will restore your habitation of righteousness, or your righteous dwelling. So if you're really right with God, as you say, Job, Bildad is saying, surely God will restore you. And on the surface, this sounds like a word of encouragement, doesn't it? But really, beneath the surface, it's actually an accusation. Basically, he's saying, if things don't change soon, Job, it's your fault.
If you were pure and upright, because you're not.
Right.
That's basically what he's saying.
Exactly. Again, yeah, friends like this, we don't need enemies.
That's right. You just mentioned chen, the favor and grace. And just speaking of bringing the verses and tying together the explanation, it just reminds me, and I just have to say again, there is an excellent explanation of grace in Nehemiah's new book.
Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence.
If you haven't got it already, everybody, I highly recommend it. There is a link on the sidebar of truthtoyou.org. You can click on it. It will take you to nehemiahswall.com. Nehemiahswall.com is the website where you can order that book. It's an excellent book, and it does tie in an excellent explanation of that word. I really do highly recommend it.
And if you're out there and you're listening and you have a congregation, you should contact Nehemiah, nehemiahswall.com, because Nehemiah is spending some time here in the States, and I'm sure he would be very happy if you contact him to try and make some kind of arrangements to come out and speak to your group or speak to your congregation.
He's going to be there for a number of months, and so if you contact him via nehemiahswall.com, even a prayer to our father.com, you'll be able to organize, I'm sure, some seminars, lectures, some meetings that would be highly beneficial. And again, once again, Shattering the Conspiracy of Silence, excellent book, highly recommend it. Before we jump entirely off the topic, it just popped into my head. You did mention just before 1 Samuel 16 in regards to the Lord sending Saul an evil spirit. Just wanted to throw into the mix also, just for the listeners when they're doing some homework, Judges chapter 9, verse 23, we see another example of that where God sends an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. And so there's another one to add to the mix.
Yep.
Now we are in verse 8, because in 7, though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly. Now, wait a minute.
Yeah, let's talk about this for a minute.
Let's talk about that.
Let's go back to 7, because there's something interesting here. Here's more of what I call Bildad's two-edged encouragement. And it's actually a clever poetic foreshadowing of what really is the case, mm-hmm. that Job is upright and God does restore him in the end. So we kind of see this poetic foreshadowing here in this of the end of the chapter, or the end of the book, I'm sorry, but he hasn't done it yet. So even though Job is righteous, he doesn't look like it right now. Mm-hmm. And Bildad is judging from appearances rather than from the truth. So in these verses, we could, he kind of gives this advice that really is kind of quite simple, and we noted the issues with this type of encouragement. You know, we saw this with Eliphaz as well. But the fact is, and I had to ask myself this question when I was looking at this, when I was studying this chapter, why Job did not think of this himself? In other words, what I'm saying is, instead of compromising his entire belief system that, oh, I'm righteous and I didn't do anything wrong, and why is God, you know, testing me in this way, could he have accepted his own human fallibility? You know, again, I'm the perspective guy. You know, so I sometimes bring the literal, but I also want to give different perspectives. And kind of recognize maybe the possibility that he may have erred in some way in the past, that maybe there's the slightest possibility that he had tarnished his otherwise sterling reputation that he's standing up against these guys with. And then on the other hand, he could continue to maintain his absolute righteousness and attribute his present troubles to some future consideration, like what Bildad was describing. And so it's kind of like, what we're talking about is a temporary loss for the sake of a much greater future gain. But Eov doesn't do that. Okay, Job doesn't do that. Instead, he, I believe, he kind of errs in his thinking process and comes to it to kind of the unverifiable conclusion that Yehovah has somehow abandoned him.
Yeah, and I think, but, you know, in Job's defense, in his defense, I kind of feel like he's almost not allowed to have that option as part of his testing. It's almost as if that option is so far beyond him that he doesn't even have a chance to consider it. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I mean, it's possible, but you know, we don't have the opportunity to really say, because he doesn't come out and say, you know, I've sinned before you, or who am I, you know, I just don't think, and of course, remember, we know the end of the book, sure. so it's hard to give an opinion having, you know, when we know the end of it. But really, the truth of the matter is does Job really know God? And I'm not saying he wasn't serving God, but does he really know him? Okay? And what I'm trying to say is I think that this teaches us a really incredible lesson as well, because when one of us is in the thick of emotional and physical turmoil, this is not the best time to adopt. There's a German word for this. It's called Weltanschauung, okay, which means a new worldview.
Sure.
And I think what's happening here is that you know, here's a guy who's considered upright and blameless in the sight of Yehovah, and he's changed his worldview. I mean, here he served him, and now suddenly he's taken on this completely new worldview as it relates to Yehovah. And that's why I'm saying, you know, that he didn't even for a minute stop and think, well, wait a minute. You know, let me sit and think. Is there something? I mean, yeah, I don't know about you, but, you know.
I don't know. I'm a little bit more sympathetic to Job, I think. not to say that you're not, but if we go back to chapter 6 and the final verses of chapter 6, he says to his friend, I think he's still talking to Eliphaz, and he says, "Now therefore be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Yield now, let there be no injustice. Yes, concede my righteousness still stands. Is there injustice on my tongue? Can I not discern the unsavory?" And so he has considered, and he even said somewhere, you know, if I've done something wrong, you guys, if you know that I've done something wrong, tell me what it is, because I'm teachable. Tell me, because I am teachable. I'll listen
right.
to you. I'll
right.
consider
but
it.
But did he ask Yehovah that question?
Oh, I'm sure he must have, though. Surely he must have.
I don't know. When he changed over in his position, when he starts talking, and then he goes from the plural to the singular, I don't remember necessarily in the singular that he starts saying, you know, tell me what I've done, you know, and I'll repent. You know, it seems like he kind of changes his position on, you know, and feeling sure. that somehow he's been abandoned.
Certainly possible. And the other thing, of course, to realize is that such extreme experiences always, for better or worse, teaches us something. You cannot remain the same after. And so, and regardless of how upright or pure you may be, there's always the next level of maturity to come to. And you may not, again, possess a certain perspective until you've gone through that and matured to the next level. And so, again, I don't know that we can blame Job for not being there yet.
And look, I'm not hanging my hat on any of these things. Remember, I mean, you know, my job is to kind of bring perspective here and say, look, we're dealing with a very obscure book. You know, we can't know for sure exactly what we're saying half of the time, you know, so we do the best we can with in the translation. But then we have to kind of look at different perspectives and examine whether there's another way of looking at this. And I think part of my position will be made more clear as we get towards the latter verses.
I'm sure that'll be the case. And I got to say, even though, even though his friends so far, Eliphaz and Bildad, haven't quite got it, and they aren't approaching it from the perspective that they should be, there's little compassion. One thing that strikes me about all of this dialogue is just how philosophically brilliant it is, and how profound almost every second sentence is. And this is one of them in verse 8. "For inquire, please, of the former age, and consider the things discovered by their fathers." Every single thing that comes out of these guys' mouths is crafted Ira. It's all crafted, and it's as if it's mathematically measured everything.
Mm-hmm. But I look at that verse and for ask now, you know, of a former generation and establish it as something their fathers have searched out. That's the way I would read it from the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And to me, this could be an allusion that Bildad is alluding to Eliphaz as the elder speaking on their behalf.
Sure.
In other words, it's a truth established by former generations. And what is the truth that's established by former generations? In verse 9, we see it.
For we were born yesterday and know nothing.
Right. Mm. All our days are a shadow upon the earth.
Yeah.
You know, our lives are nothing. There he goes. But I think we can allude to it because we've talked about the idea that Eliphaz was probably the elder, which is why he spoke first. And I think that he's kind of bringing kind of a double rebuke, like he's saying, here I am, you know, trying to speak truth to you. You already didn't listen to the elder that came. You know, to the one that's bringing you the truth from our fathers.
That's right. And he clearly concurs with Eliphaz. And I do believe, at least as I read it, I really get the feeling that he's gained momentum and a little bit of probably extra courage to go hard on Job because of Eliphaz.
Well, sure. Look what he says him in verse 10.
Yeah. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words from their heart?
Right. Yeah. So are you going to listen to the testimony of the generations that have gone before us? Because if you do, it proves that what I'm saying is right. Mm. That's what he's saying, basically.
And so from 11 on, almost to...
About 17 or 18, I think.
18, yeah. He's drawing some illustrations, really, isn't he, from nature?
Very pictorial, you know, descriptions from nature. Yeah.
Can the papyrus... grow up without a marsh? Can reeds flourish without water? While it is yet green and not cut down, it withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God. There's a jab.
Mm-hmm.
All those who forget God, he's suggesting to Job that he's forgotten God. And the hope of the hypocrite shall perish. Now he's saying to him, and you're a hypocrite. Those whose confidence shall be cut off, whose trust is a spider's web. He leans on his house, but it does not stand. He holds it fast, but it does not endure. He grows green in the sun, and his branches spread wide, spread out in his garden. His roots wrap around the rock heaps and look for a place in the stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I have not seen you. So he's suggesting to him that he's forgotten God, that he's a hypocrite, and that he, if I understand in regards to the spider's web, the way I read it, Ira, is he seems to be saying, you put all your eggs in one basket, buddy, and you thought that you were good. You relied on your wealth and on your on everything that you had, and you saw that as your strength.
Right. So, I mean, you know, so we see these in verse 11, the idea of the papyrus, you know, or the reeds, or do rushes grow without water? Rushes is kind of another type of plant that actually usually grows in infertile soil. Basically, we already know the answer. Of course they don't. They grow in water and can't survive without it. And then it says in verse 12, still longer while green or fresh plucked, and before all grass, it withers. So it grows in the water, yet even without being cut, it withers before other plants. Right. And so what it is it kind of looks on the outside like it's doing well, yet it dies more quickly than other plants.
I've got to read this out because as I've just been reading this, it reminds me of another verse. And, of course, it's Jeremiah 17. And from verse 5, I think, yeah. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his strength, whose heart departs from the Lord, for he shall be like a shrub in the desert and shall not see when the good comes, but shall inhabit the parched places of the wilderness in salt land, which is not inhabited. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose hope is in the Lord, for he shall be like a tree planted by the waters, which spread out its roots by the river and will not fear when heat comes. But its leaf will be green, and it will not be anxious in the year of drought, nor will it cease from yielding fruit. There's a lot of the other thing about Job's friends, they do speak a lot of truth. There's a lot of truth in there.
Absolutely. Absolutely, they do. Yeah. It's absolutely, and that's a great verse to bring because it really speaks about it. Because when we start to talk about this idea of the roots going out, we see a kind of a different perspective here in the book of Job, that's quite distinct from what we just read in Jeremiah. In verse 13, so are the paths of all who forget God, as you said, and a hope of the godless will perish. He's basically saying that's what it's like for those who turn away from God. It looks like things are going great, but suddenly they wither. And even though he's not really saying it directly, he's implying that Job is one of those who has forgotten God, like you said, and for whom everything now has withered as a result. And this was a really interesting verse in verse 14. It says, "Asher yakot kislo uveit akavish mivtacho." Okay, and there's some interesting words there. Again, these are the obscure words, because Yakot, Asher Yakot, Yakot actually I think only appears in this only one time in the Tanakh, and I think it's here in Job chapter 8 verse 14. And that word Yakot, where it's translated as confidence, it could actually mean folly or stupidity. So it's a false kind of confidence. It's not talking about confidence. And why that's interesting is because what we see is at the end of the verse, mivtacho, okay, comes from like the same root of bitachon, which is trust. So this confidence, this yakot, can mean this folly or stupidity. And the idea of this fragility can mean something else, because it has so many different meanings, Yakot. Some think that it comes from the root kot, which can mean to loathe, but there are others that believe that it comes from katat, which is related to gossamer, which makes more sense, because gossamer is spider silk, and we're getting into this idea of the idea of the house and house related to the spider's web. So it kind of makes sense here. Sure. But I think that it's really cool that we see the distinction between this kind of this false confidence that's being spoken of, you know, as opposed to bitachon, the real trust, the real word for trust in Hebrew. He leans on his house, meaning he leans on the spider web and it does not stand. He told hold of it and it does not rise up again. And so it's the idea of like a spider's web. It doesn't hold up, but it collapses. Now a spider web will hold up for a spider, and a spider web is really strong. But what he's saying is, you know, you try to set it back up again, but he can't, as it relates to your house, the way it's fallen. And isn't this what so many people hope, what so many people's hope is? It's and I'm going to say something very controversial, but we do that all the time on this
That's
show
right.
and other shows.
So hold back.
And what I mean by that is that this is the same thing that people do when they have a web of false beliefs that they hang on to desperately at times. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that web may be really strong for a spider, but that web of false beliefs will not hold up for you. And once it's been destroyed, it cannot be built up again. And I know you know what I'm talking about, Jonah. And we'll just, amen. So in verse 16, we see Ratov hu lifnei shamesh va'al ganato yinakto tetse. He is moist. He stays fresh before the sun, and over his branches go out. So there's that same kind of reference to we see that idea of the roots going out. Basically, we can say that the godless, or Bildad is saying the godless person has his day in the sun when everything seems to be going all right. And then we read in verse 17, Al gal shavashav yisuvachuvet avanim yichezeh, upon a heap of stones. His roots are interwoven, a house of stones he sees it to be, or he imagines it to be. This is a very interesting verse. His roots are wrapped around a pile of rocks.
Desperately searching for a place to find moisture and to shoot down. And to
right, but it could also kind of give this idea that this gives a false hope of these roots wrapped around the rock as kind of providing some kind of enduring, a foundation for the house. And like I said, a spider's web, which we see is, you know, really, if you look at them really closely, they're just so amazing, you know, as it relates to how industrious spiders are. But it's so fragile and feeble in our world. So as you said, Bill Dodd is using these powerful and vivid pictures from the natural world, but he really misapplies them to Job as if he were sinning. And he was this kind of shallow hypocrite. He's really calling him a hypocrite is what's happening. And like Eliphaz, we have to say Bildad was right in his statements of truth, like you said, and yet quite wrong in his intended application so far as Job was concerned. And this is where it gets interesting when we talk about that pile or that heap of stones. Because it says in 18, if it swallows him... this idea of swallowing him from his place or removing him from his place, then it will deny or reject him, saying, I didn't see you. And so this is related to that heap of stones and the context of that and the house that he thinks he has built according to Bildad. But being swallowed here in this heap of stones can actually be an image of death, as in the Hebrew name for death, Avadon, which means a place of destruction. And we see that with Korach in Numbers chapter 16, verse 32, and it says, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households and all the men who belonged to Korach with their possessions.
Yes.
And we see Avadon five times, and three of them are in Job alone. In Job 26:6, it says, Sheol is naked in front of him. To Avadon there is no cover. In 28:22, Avadon and death say, in our ears we hear a report. This is actually speaking of in chapter 28. This is Job speaking, and he talks about wisdom and understanding. Where is wisdom and understanding? And this is one of the answers. Avadon and death say, in our ears we hear a report of it, but we've never seen it. And then finally in 31:12, it says, because a fire is as far as Avadon consuming, all my harvest she uproots. And so if the pile of stones on which the plant of the wicked is growing could kind of swallow him as a result of his death, it will never admit he was there. And so this is kind of a poetic way of saying that there will be no evidence that he ever lived. And the image can kind of even go deeper, because a pile of stones was actually one of the ancient forms of burial in the areas in which Job and his friends were living, used not long before their time. You can still see some of these burial sites in places like the Golan and in an ancient Gilead.
Truly.
And so from this point of view, the stones that the wicked had hoped would provide an enduring house has instead become a tomb for them. And so, if so, it's just this idea of that it can be a comment on the passage of time and the ruins of preceding generations that dot the land. So, I mean, you know, just kind of very interesting.
Taking all of that into consideration, Ira, I'm not too sure how to interpret the first sentence of verse 19. Behold, this is the joy of his way.
Right.
Is that what you've got in the Hebrew?
So it says, it says, behold, this is the joy of his way, and from the dust another will sprout up. So basically, for me, what this is kind of saying is that the joy of the wicked is kind of a brief season of prosperity, which soon ends.
Hang on a minute. Hang on. Whoa. You just said the joy of the wicked is what?
A brief season of prosperity, which soon ends.
Do you know why? Do you know where the confusion came from?
I
was confused, Ira. I was confused. Let me tell you why I was confused. What I have in verse 19 is, behold, this is the joy of his way. Let me read it again. Behold, this is the joy of his, capital H, way.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Okay, well, look, what can I say, my friend, you know?
let's spell this out for the listeners.
Reading the wrong version. Okay, let me use my famous line that I tell people, okay? Text without context is pretext.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say that again. Text without context is pretext.
Okay, now, in a nutshell, just explain to the listeners what just happened here. So behold, this is the joy of God's way, or behold, this is the joy of the wicked man's way.
Right, so this is what we're talking about. We're talking about in the context. You can't separate this verse out suddenly that everything's changed now. We have to do it in context of what we've been reading, and what we've been reading is about this, this person who's been devoured. By this pile of stones, and we've given this imagery of the idea of a tomb. Hasn't changed somehow to talking about Yehovah now. It's kind of a poetic language related to what we've already talked about that is talking about kind of just what we said, that another one will, when we read the end, and from the dust another will sprout up. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not talking. What would that mean? Basically, what it's saying is that just like there's this brief season, or like this, you know, they had their day in the sun, like we talked about before. You know, they're moist and fresh in the sun, but really they just wither away. That this is just a brief season of their prosperity, then leaves no trace of his existence. Why? Because he's forgotten, and then there are others like him that are going to follow. There are others that are going to sprout up from the dust just like him, and they're going to have the same way. Their way is going to be the same way. Just
there it is. And so I figured out why they have decided that the he or his way is in reference to God. The New King James has equated that with Psalm 113 verse 7, which says, he raises the poor out of the dust and lifts the needy out of the ash heap. And so they've looked at that and they've gone, well,
I have no idea where they got that from.
They put two and two together, but the twos came from different equations, unfortunately.
Sometimes I wonder whether these guys knew Hebrew at all. But they're supposed to be scholars. I'm not even a Hebrew scholar, and I seem to,
But you know what they've done? You know what they have done, Ira, is they've made the same mistake as Bildad. What they've done is they've looked at, they've falsely deduced that they've looked at something and they've decided already where they want to go, and they've taken a verse from Psalm 113, and that's an absolutely fair and correct verse. And it's true in what it says, but they've taken that truth and said, it applies here, over here. In the same way that Bildad looks at Job and goes, I'm looking at your situation, and therefore I know, because of the situation that you're in, you are to blame. You've done something wrong.
Right.
It applies here. And so it's an interesting thing. But it goes on to say, behold, God will not cast away the blameless. Again, he's saying you are to blame. Nor will he uphold the evildoers.
Right.
Okay. Yet he will fill your mouth with laughing. Now I'm a little confused, because the last two verses seem to offer some hope to Job, and maybe it reads differently in the Hebrew. I'll read it to the end of 22. Yet he will fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame. If that's not a prophecy against himself, I don't know what it is. And well, it's not as if they hate Job. They don't hate Job. But he's saying those who hate you will be clothed with shame. And the dwelling place of the wicked will come to nothing. In the last two verses, even possibly three, is he offering some? Is he putting like a disclaimer on his speech?
So let's look at this for a second. So remember, we talked about, you brought the idea that he's kind of throwing Job's words back at him, mm-hmm. as it relates to him being a windbag that we read earlier in the chapter. But this is where we really see him throwing. Well, not throwing back, but there is at least this connection to the earlier verses, because it says, "Hen elo yimastam." Okay, behold, God does not reject the blameless tam, and does not strengthen the hand of those who are evil. God does not aid evildoers, nor does he turn away from the righteous, is what he's saying. So since God has obviously rejected you, Job, you must not be blameless. There must be sin in your life. And so here's the irony. The irony is that Bildad uses the same Hebrew word, tam, against Job that God used earlier in his favor.
Yeah, in his favor. He actually said that Job is blameless.
Chapter 1, verse 8. Vayomer Yohel ha-Satan, ha-samta livcha al-avdi Iov ki ein Kamoho Ba'aretz Ishtam V'yashar Yirei Elohim V'sar Mera. And then we see in 2:3 as well, it's almost exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. He says, and Yehovah said to HaSatan, have you considered the heart, of my servant Job? There's none like him in all the earth. A blameless man, an ish tam v'yashar, upright, who fears Elohim and shuns mera. There's that word ra again. He shuns evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see, so he's basically, at the end of the 2:3 that he adds on, and he still keeps his integrity, so you've incited me against him for no good reason, that he says to HaSatan Yehovah. And then we see verse 21, like you said, it says, until he fills your mouth with laughter and your lips with a shout of joy. And I underline shout because it's the word teruah, like we have Yom Teruah coming out, the day of shouting, or the day of trumpets. And then I love verse 22. I love it because it really has this connection to our modern language. It says, "Sonecha yilbeshu boshem." I'm sorry, "Yilbeshu voshem vaohel rasha'im enenu." Okay, and "sonecha" is your haters. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it basically says your haters will be clothed with shame and a tent of the wicked will be more. So basically what he's saying is, I don't know that he's, I guess, yes, in a way you could say that what he's doing is there's kind of like that offhand encouragement. He's basically saying, you know what, Job, there's still hope for you. You just need to get right with God and all your troubles will go away.
Mm-hmm.
And Bildad completes what I like to call his theology of retribution. and this is the thing. Bildad may believe he has the wisdom of the ancients and he has his own belief system, and both of which, for him, both of them agree, and to him they seem unshakable. But what seems to be lacking, and this is why I said this earlier, that maybe when we get to the end of the chapter, I'll kind of make sense of what I was talking about earlier. See, what he seems to be lacking was his own understanding of Yehovah. I don't think Bildad understood Yehovah the way he thought he did.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Bildad and the other counselors of Job have no problem pontificating.
Mm-hmm.
We already know that. But what I would ask is, what I would really ask is the same question that I would ask anybody that comes with this kind of language, this kind of encouragement or lack of in our modern day. I know that you can speak, I know that you can talk, but do you know how to pray, and do you know how to really console? Because it would seem that Bildad had very little real experience with God, and this is what I'm saying, and yet Job, through all of this, is being prepared to experience God so closely that towards the end of our book, he could say in Job 4:25, "Now my eyes see you."
So that is it. That concludes chapter 8, which is Bildad's speech. And in the following chapters, Job gets to respond to him. And we're going to get into that next week. Ira Michelson, Torah teacher, my friend, this has been marvelous. Thank you so much for coming back onto Treasures from the Tanakh. I look forward to speaking with you again next week.
And, always my pleasure.
Just to the listeners, by all means, send in questions or comments on the website truth2u.org. That's truth2u.org. We look forward to those. And until next week, dear listeners, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.